This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 24th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from Eureka Springs, celebrating fun in February with Mardi Gras parades, jazz events, costume balls, and a special art exhibit. More information, including a vacation planner and newsletter registration, available on the web at eurekasprings.org.
Ahead on Ozarks, tigers at Turpentine Creek near Eureka use a canvas to create art, but they substitute their tongue for a paintbrush. Jacqueline Froelich spent a day watching the big cats create that art.
Plus, the Arkansas House Minority Leader Greg Letting of Fayetteville talks to Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business about the Democratic agenda for the 89th General Assembly. And Kyle talks to Paul Haas, the conductor of the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, about Saturday night's concert at Walton Arts Center.
First, a bill to allow churches to let members carry a concealed handgun to worship services is advancing to the Senate in Little Rock for a vote. The Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday approved the Church Protection Act of 2013. Senator Brian King, a Republican from Green Forest, sponsored the legislation. He says churches should be allowed to handle their own security.
We need more citizen protection measures and less gun control. And we know that churches are being robbed, that we know that pastors have to deal with difficult situations. I mentioned, a lot of times youth programs, we have kids showing up with ankle bracelets.
Senator Stephanie Flowers, a Democrat from Pine Bluff, tried to add an amendment to the bill that would require churches allowing guns to have an insurance policy that would pay damages to someone injured or killed by an individual with an authorized concealed weapon.
All this does is puts into place protection for individuals in the event something happens in that church that is unexpected.
Committee members chose not to adopt the amendment, saying they were unsure if such a policy existed and whether small congregations could afford such a policy. A representative from the National Rifle Association spoke against the amendment and for the bill, and that bill did pass unanimously.
Senator Mark Pryor will formally kick off his reelection campaign in March. Campaign manager Jeff Weaver says the campaign will have to start early in order to raise the needed funds for the November 2014 election. On March 16th, President Clinton will headline a fundraiser for Senator Pryor, along with former Senators Dale Bumpers and David Pryor.
We're thrilled to have them. We're glad that they were all able to make it. And Governor Beebe is one of the most popular politicians in the state. And they're also all four good friends, well, former Senator Pryor's his father. They're all very popular politicians in Arkansas. And they're all good friends of Senator Pryor's. And I think they add a lot of star power to the event that we're going to have in March.
There will be a dinner at the Peabody Hotel, followed by events at the State House Convention Center.
A Republican plan to suspend the nation's debt limit on borrowing for 4 months now heads to the Senate after passing in the House in Washington yesterday. Senator John Bozeman of Arkansas says while he hasn't read the exact language of the bill yet, he's inclined to support it.
I think the idea of providing some breathing room is certainly, something that is a legitimate reason to push it off for a couple months, which really is what the House has done. So what we've got to do is have an open process, and these are really difficult decisions that need to be made. We simply can't keep spending more money than we have.
Senator Bozeman says he would like to have a lot of hearings and get input from the American public before debate over the debt ceiling resumes in a few months. Democratic leaders in the Senate also support the current bill, as does the White House.
About 6 miles of dirt roads in Washington County are scheduled to be paved in the coming year. County roads 41 by Winslow, 46 by Elkins, 97 east of Springdale, and 612 and 80 near Prairie Grove are all on the county's road improvement schedule for 2013. But Assistant County Road Superintendent Sean Shrum says that the weather has to be agreeable before paving can start.
Whenever it warms up, we'll go back out, reset that base up, and get it ready to pave or chip seal. And we're working on some more, but we've got that going on. We're going to be doing more miles of chip seal reseal.
Shrum says that county road crews normally reseal about 45 miles of roads per year, but that number varies according to the road maintenance schedule.
The University of Arkansas Library Special Collection Department is accepting applications for a new fellowship. The Lionel Jordan Fellowship in Labor and Working Class Studies will reimburse up to $500 in expenses accrued while researching Arkansas labor history, culture, education, trade union traditions, and worker culture. According to a release from the university, the fellowship is meant to encourage the study of various aspects of working people in Arkansas and to support publishable research about the lives of working people that might otherwise fall outside of the bounds of traditional academic research and funding. Applications must be postmarked by February 15th. All research must be completed between March 1st of this year and February 28th of next. The fellowship is named in honor of Fayetteville's mayor, who worked as a carpenter for 26 years in the university's facilities management department. He was also president of the local chapter of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees and president of the Northwest Arkansas Labor Council.
J.B. Hunt Transport Services announced record fourth quarter earnings this morning. According to a release by the trucking giant, revenue for the fourth quarter of 2012 was pegged at $1.3 billion, an increase of 11% from fourth quarter 2011. The company's operating income for the quarter also rose 17% over the previous year, totaling just more than $143 million. For the full fiscal year, J.B. Hunt reported $5.1 billion in revenue, a 12% increase over the previous year. And operating income for the year totaled $530 million, an increase of 19% over 2011 figures.
It should be cloudy throughout the KUAF listening area tonight. Lows will be in the mid to upper 20s in northwest Arkansas. There is a 30% chance of rain before midnight for the Arkansas River Valley. Lows right around freezing. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs around 50 for the Arkansas River Valley. Upper 40s tomorrow in northwest Arkansas. And for Friday night, mostly clear. Lows from 25 to 30 throughout the region.
On Tuesday, the Old Fort Homeless Coalition in Fort Smith held a point-in-time count of the city's sheltered and unsheltered homeless. Though the Department of Housing and Urban Development requires a count of unsheltered every other year, the coalition voted to count both sheltered and unsheltered each year because the data will aid their efforts to open a homeless campus for the unsheltered. In 2011, there were 235 homeless. Of those, 82 were unsheltered, meaning living by the river, under the bridge, or in a car. In January of 2012, the count was 211, 65 of those unsheltered. Yesterday, I spoke with Ken Pyle, president of the Old Fort Homeless Coalition, who says that reduction in numbers could have more to do with the weather than a real improvement.
Last year, where there was like 2.5 inches of rain in the 24 hours, and what you find is that the homeless on these difficult days will band together and rent a room at a low-cost motel, or they'll double up with folks, and they'll come in out of the rain, as it were, for that period. But they're truly still homeless. But so the timing of the point and count today has something to do with the count. But in general, those numbers have stayed pretty steady between 210 and 230 for the last 3 or 4 years. May not know that the city of Fort Smith went through some difficult times back in 2009 and 2010 with regard to some of our homeless shelters wanting to expand, and we ran into planning commission denials and neighborhoods saying not in my backyard. And so the city board, after a pretty contentious community meeting led by our chief of police, he did a good job of trying to keep the contention down, but the fact is there were some strong feelings. The city appointed a homeless task force that met for, I believe, around 9 or 10 months. There were 6 citizen representatives from around the city, and there were 6 nonprofit representatives. And that 12-person task force presented a list of recommendations to the city board in May of 2010, that the board then adopted and prioritized, basically said we need to hire a homeless coordinator, we need to figure out how to build a homeless campus, we need to do some things with city services to improve our responsiveness, we need to allocate more funds to the homeless efforts here in town. So it was really a wonderful deal. A lot of communities struggle with the political. There's a lot going on out there in the political getting away. In our case, Fort Smith got the political done up front, and we've been spending the last 2 years gathering our data, making sure we knew who our homeless were and what their services needs were. And then we've gone now to getting these grants for the homeless campus.
And these counts help you get, I mean, these counts, you're actually interviewing homeless and finding out what their needs are.
Yeah, you're not just driving down the street and counting people that look like they're homeless. You sit down and get as much information as you can from them about their medical situations, where they slept the night before, have they been homeless before, age, are they part of a family, you know, are their family members homeless? You try to gather as much demographic information as you can, and then that goes into the homeless management information system to both eliminate duplicates and to allow us to do some studies as to what our gaps are. And for us, the gaps that have been revealed in the last 2 years of unsheltered is that we need another option for folks.
I have to imagine that it's probably difficult for people to talk about their situations. So how do you go about approaching them?
I'll tell you, it requires a lot of caring. It requires some incentives. We have a goodie bag that we offer them for sharing their information with us. A couple of years ago, and this is nothing against volunteers, but we asked people to just come in off the street and help us. And what we found was that unless you work in this area, you kind of don't know what the language is of the homeless. You have no understanding of where they're really coming from. And so you can come off a little either cold or abrupt or whatever. So the last few years, we have used people from the task force who became very familiar with the homeless situation. We've used folks that are either working in the nonprofit area providing services. That has helped us a lot. We've found that both the quality of information we get and the number of people that positively respond has gone up.
So yesterday was it was sunny. It was a little cold. How did it go?
It went well. We had a very good response from the people. They were open and accepting. They've gotten used to seeing our goodie bags. And, you know, it's kind of like whatever it takes to get them to come in and talk to you. We had people stationed at the Salvation Army and the Rescue Mission and Next Step Day Room, and others went out and visited the camps out on the river. The anecdotal reports I had from the people that were doing it is that there was a slightly younger crowd at the Salvation Army this year. The numbers were up for the people that did this that had comparisons from last year. But until we put the numbers into the computer and resolve the duplicates, you really don't know. So that'll take us about another month before we have the data reduced and collated.
All right. What else?
I was going to say that, going back to the task force, one of the biggest frustrations that the homeless task force in Fort Smith had was they spent months arguing over how many homeless we have. And what we needed, though, is how many beds do we have versus how many beds do we actually need? And so that's why we've decided to do this unsheltered and sheltered count each year. It was important. It's important for communities to have numbers that are defendable, that you aren't worried about somebody come up and saying, well, you know, last year it was 200, this year it's 300. Is it really that much worse, or do you just count differently? We think we've got a pretty good system here, and we have people that are experienced in doing it, and that will help in the collection of the data.
This data is going to help you with the homeless campus. I have to imagine that some people actually prefer to sleep under a bridge or in one of the tent communities over living in a shelter.
I think it'd be fairer to say that given the options we have available in town, yes, they prefer living out.
Mm-hmm.
But the Salvation Army, and this is no knock on them, the Salvation Army and Community Rescue Mission have rules. You can only stay there a certain number of nights. If you're drunk, they may not let you in. Can't be high. You've got an animal, they won't let you in. They'll only let you bring a certain amount of your personal belongings. Those are all barriers to people coming in off the street. And what we're trying to do with our low-demand shelter in our campus is to have something we're labeling First Step, a place where we'll provide unlimited storage. There are only four rules that keep you from coming onto the campus. One is you can't bring alcohol in, you can't bring drugs in, you can't bring weapons, and you have to act appropriately, no violent behavior. Anything else is allowed. You can be as high as you want. You can be as drunk as you want. You can leave sober and come back an hour later and be drunk, and we'll let you in. You can't bring any alcohol. We don't want people living in the street because their medications are not controlled. I mean, there's just so many debilitating things that happen living out there. Some people, no doubt, there are some veteran homeless, if you will, not military veteran, but people who are experienced at living out there that keep themselves hydrated and all that other stuff. But the heck of a lot of other folks are dehydrated and sleeping well, and they're worried about being raped or assaulted. Or I mean, it's a rough environment.
Sounds scary.
Yeah, and people that have this romantic view of living out under the stars and how wonderful it is, go try it. If we had another choice, I think the vast majority, we won't get 100% into our loaded shelter, but we'll get most of the folks.
And you said that the timeline for this?
We are applying for various grants and funds through both the federal and local. We hope to purchase a building at 301 Southeast Street sometime this fall, commence the renovation shortly thereafter, and we would hope to be up and operating sometime in 2014, probably mid 2014.
Okay, well, I look forward to following it.
Thank you very much, Christina,
okay.
And we appreciate your interest.
That's guitarist David Gilmour from his CD Unified Presence. Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg. This Saturday on Shades of Jazz at 10 p.m., I'll feature music from David Gilmour. We'll also hear trumpeter Terrell Stafford, guitarist John Schofield, saxophonist Greg Osby, and much, much more. That's the Saturday edition of Shades of Jazz at 10 p.m.
This is Ozarks at Large. Greg Letting, a member of the Arkansas House of Representatives from Fayetteville, is the first Democrat to hold a certain office in nearly 140 years, House Minority Leader. Democrats are the minority party in both chambers this winter, but by a slim margin, meaning successful passage of legislation will take bipartisanship efforts. This week, Greg Letting sat down with Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business to discuss the Democratic Party agenda for the 89th General Assembly.
We've seen some details from the Republicans. They have put forth a simple plan, which has some tenets that they subscribe to. We're seeing some legislation filed on that part. I want to come back and ask you about that specifically. But first of all, what are the Democrats going to do in terms of putting forward an agenda?
We're going to carry forward the commitments that we campaigned on. You know, we know that jobs and our economy continue to be the most important issue to Arkansans. Education continues to be an incredibly important issue. So we're going to work to strengthen our schools. You know, we've made a lot of progress in that area in the last several years, but we know we still have some work to do. We know that health care is an area where Arkansas has actually received some national praise in terms of the innovation, like with the Payment Improvement Initiative that we've seen, with the fact that, you know, we went from having no trauma system to an incredible trauma system in the span of just a couple of years. But we know that we lead the nation in stroke mortality. We know that we have an obesity problem. So that'll continue to be a priority for us. We know that obviously Medicaid is going to be one of the major issues of this session. But then also government issues. I think government gets a bad rap. You know, and we are also, we're often labeled as the party of big government, which is absolutely not true. But we do believe in a strong government that's able to take care of its people and pay its bills. And I think Democrats have historically been, in Arkansas, the party of fiscal discipline. But we want to address ethics issues going forward in this session.
Will we see specific legislation come forth on education, on ethics, on some of this government being responsible? Or are you talking about some status quo that you want to protect changes from being made to?
I think we'll see some of both. I think we have done a great job of keeping the state's fiscal house in order. So there are going to be certain things that we're going to protect.
Give me some examples.
We have some problems with, I believe it's House Bill 1041. It was right. Representative Bruce Westerman. We know that the governor and DFNA have some problems with that bill. We're kind of uncomfortable with that. We do have some colleagues who are working on some ethics legislation, and I think you're going to see some bipartisan legislation there. I don't think that's going to be one side or the other.
But you said some of it will be defense as well, so.
There will be some defensive, but we know that we spent a lot of the 88th General Assembly on defense, and we do want to play more offense this time.
You want to tip your hand a bit as to what might come forward in terms of being proactive on that front?
I think you're going to see some legislation aimed to really help and strengthen Arkansas families. We know that even though Arkansas wasn't hurt as badly as many states with the recent economic downturn, we still took a hit. And we know that we're still struggling a little bit. So I think you're going to see some bills aimed to help families and working families. Representative Butch Wilkins has already put out there, I don't believe he's filed it yet, but a bill to raise the minimum wage. I know Representative Jim Nichols, for him, you know, working Arkansans are a top priority, and this is his last term. They're going to continue to be a top priority for him. So I think you're going to see a few bills from him. But we'll have more specifics.
One of the things that the Republicans have talked about doing, and they are in the majority, so we mm-hmm. have to kind of put it in that context, income tax reform. Charlie Collins, one of your colleagues from Fayetteville, is going to be leading the Revenue and Tax Committee, where they have a supermajority on that committee. Do you see problems with creating a middle income tax bracket where there is tax relief for people in that middle income territory?
I would love to see tax relief for all Arkansans, but I think we have to do it responsibly. And we are working on our own ideas. We do recognize that Republicans on the House committee do have a supermajority. It's 15-5. But when you get to the House floor, it is still just 51-49. And historically, the speaker doesn't vote. That's not to say he won't, mm-hmm. but it's not the majority that they thought they were going to have weeks before the election, or even the day of the election. And same goes in the Senate. I still think you're going to see common sense and level-headed, cool heads prevail.
Do you think some of that is because the governor does have the ability to veto some of that, which would cause the legislature to have to override his veto, which they have the numbers to do?
It's a simple majority. You need 51 votes in the House and just 18 votes in the Senate to override a veto. I don't think it's necessarily a given. I have no insight as to whether or not the governor is willing and ready to veto something. I do think that if he did, it's not necessarily a slam dunk that we would override it. I do think the governor vetoing a piece of legislation would give some people pause, but we'll see.
You mentioned ethics earlier. Give me an example beyond ethics of one thing where you really see consensus between Republicans and Democrats where you think you will be working together on a major, significant accomplishment, maybe Medicaid.
I think Medicaid will be the significant achievement of this session. It is clearly the dominant topic, both in terms of the shortfall, but the expansion of Medicaid. I know that the chances are not necessarily great at this point, but I do think it's something that the more we learn about, the more we hear about the positive economic impact of extending the program, the more we hear about the dire consequences of not extending the program, the more people seem to be willing to talk, whereas, you know, months ago, you couldn't even get a conversation going. So I really do believe by the time we get near the end of session, there's a chance that we can get that done.
What do you see as a line in the sand where you can tell right now with about 100% accuracy, Democrats are going to side right here on this issue, Republicans are going to side right here on this issue, and we're just going to have to duke this one out?
I'm sure there are some issues like that out there right now, but I genuinely, I can't think of one at the moment. Most issues out there right now sort of have supporters on both sides. And I think Speaker Carter has made it clear that he really wants to see consensus from both parties. I genuinely want both parties, where we can, to work together. I would like to see the public's opinion of lawmakers go up. And I think that one of the best ways we can do that is to work together, have honest, open debate, dispense with some of the theatrics that we've seen in the past, and actually come up with a positive solution.
So you don't see voter ID or charter schools or school vouchers or any of those hot button issues, maybe even some of the gun or abortion bills? You don't see any of those?
Those will definitely be some serious fights. I don't necessarily see them as being exclusively partisan. You've got Democrats who would maybe like to see some more sensible approach to gun laws, but you have some for whom it's a non-starter. Same with some of the reproductive rights bills. Voter ID, I think, will be a pretty major issue. Charter schools, too, because you start talking about charter schools, those tend to threaten public schools in rural areas. And so I think you're going to see some pushback there, but I don't necessarily think of them as partisan issues.
Democrats have always been joked that they're a party where they're not really a party. You know, you've got all these different splinters, and they all come together under this umbrella. Do you think Republicans are seeing that now with their majorities now and the growth of their party? Do you kind of see? Hey, do you even joke with them? Hey, welcome to the club. You're going through what we've been going through for a long time.
I've joked a little bit with Representative John Burris. I think we did see some fractures in their party just immediately after the election. I think, by and large, those afield. I think they are operating largely as one, but I do believe they have their own factions just as we have our own factions. I do believe now, I mean, obviously I'd rather have 51 than 49, but I do believe that the Democratic caucus so far this session is more united than it might have been 2 years ago.
All right. He's Representative Greg Letting. He's a Democrat from Fayetteville. He's the House Minority Leader, as he prefers to be recognized as the House Democratic Leader. Thank you for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Greg Letting, Democratic State Representative from Fayetteville, talked to Roby Brock from Talk Business this week as part of Talk Business's daily wrap-ups of legislative work at the website talkbusiness.net. Support for talkbusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com. It is Thursday, January 24th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor of Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, is with us again.
And hopefully won't sneeze all over all of you.
Oh, no,
I'm not contagious.
Okay. Allergies?
Yes. And there shouldn't
Already?
Be allergies in January.
Yeah.
But then again, there shouldn't be all these things to do in January either. So.
All right. Well, let's brave the elements and see what we have.
All right. We have Art Night Out.
Oh,
at
yes.
Crystal Bridges. This is the closing event for See the Light, the Luminous Tradition in American Art. But there'll be all sorts of other things going on. Artist Laboratory Theater is performing.
Yes.
The Los Angeles-based artist Norton Wisdom is performing. The Northwest Arkansas Community College professors and students and their electronica group, Space Camp. The event begins at 7:30 and tickets are $25 by calling 418-5700. Or if you're in the River Valley, country musician Lee Bryce, who had a number one hit called A Woman Like You, is performing at the Fort Smith Convention Center at 8 o'clock tonight. Tickets are $20 at www.stubbs.com.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, we have new music from Robin Ford and Bex Marshall. Also music from Brick Fields, Trampled Underfoot, Willie Buck, and a few others. Tune in, join the fun. That's Friday night at 9 o'clock, the Generic Blues Show on KUEF. We'll see you then.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Paul Haas, who, of course, is the conductor, the music director of the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas. Sona, welcome back.
Thank you, Kyle. Pleasure to be here with you.
And it hasn't been that long since you were here in Fayetteville before, because it was the Christmas concert, and it's been not even a month, right?
Yeah, it's just over a month at this point.
Yeah.
So,
this is Masterworks 2, and this is a bold concert.
Yes, this is a concert of broad, huge, glorious strokes. The two main pieces on the program, of course, Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto, number one. This is perhaps one of the most famous pieces on the earth,
right?
And deservedly so. It's just a masterpiece, a gargantuan sound that comes out of the orchestra, that comes out of the pianist. Well, actually, technically speaking, it's not out of the pianist; it's out of the piano itself.
Right.
But we won't go into that. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful piece. Just enormous, I think, is the word for it, and just really beautiful, melodic. In fact, both of these composers, if I were to think of the composers who are the master melodists of all time, these two would be right at the top of the list. And so Prokofiev, another totally different work, of course, I mean, written in the middle of the 20th century as opposed to Tchaikovsky, who's in the 19th century. Different time periods, but just an enormous piece also. And it goes to, it really touches on some interesting and essential characters of the human spirit, this symphony, Prokofiev number 5. And we can get into that later, but just an amazing concert we're about to perform.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the pieces a little bit, but let's also talk about the guest artist. She is going to be here.
She is going to be here, yes. In fact, she was here a year ago.
That's right, just couldn't...
Yeah, exactly. Her hand was injured just before coming out here, and we had this amazing sort of group effort to get a replacement. Sergei Babayan was her replacement, who was, you know, one of the performing stars out there, and he just happened to, number one, be her teacher, number two, be available, and number three, be willing to donate his services. So it was kind of this trifecta of glory.
And he was also quite familiar with the piece.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he had just played it with one of the best orchestras in the world under one of the best conductors in the world. So it was, you know, we did pretty well a year ago. Anyway, so she has, Qingyan has in the meantime healed quite nicely and is back performing, and we're so excited to have her down here again. I was so excited a year ago, but we didn't have the opportunity to do it. So this time, it's another Russian work, and just cannot wait.
You know, these pieces were written, 70 years apart, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. Tchaikovsky, late 19th century, Prokofiev in the mid-20th century. When I was getting ready for our conversation, I realized there was something, though, that kind of linked them. Well, many things that linked them. But one,
let's start with their Russian.
Yes, they're both Russian. Both written at times of strife. But Prokofiev written during World War II, and just a year or so before he was done with his, Vladimir Horowitz performed the Tchaikovsky in this famous fundraising edition for World War II.
Right. No, that is funny. I hadn't even known about that coincidence, but it's definitely true. If you look at music, classical music, through history, there was this sort of point around, let's call it the turn of the 20th century, where music stopped being as, you know, concrete as. It didn't exist by itself as much as it had in the past. You started to get works that are deeply related to events happening in the world at that time. So, you know, you look at a piece like Tchaikovsky, Piano Concerto Number 1, and it's a piano concerto. I mean, it was written when it was written, and there were all these things going on around it, and all those things added to what Tchaikovsky was and how he wrote. But this piece is no more related to current events than, I don't know, Beethoven 9 was related to current events. I mean, it's this sort of monumental gesture to humanity, let's call it. Whereas you look at a piece like Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, which we're also performing on this program, this is deeply related to World War II. It's deeply related to everything that's gone on to the Russian people since 1917, this inexorable march towards what we know happened. This is written in a country where everyone knew what was going on, but nobody could do anything about it. So it was, this piece is at once sort of memorializing this horrific march to an awful state of affairs, but at the same time, it's a cry out to universal humanity. This is about the resilience of the human spirit in the face of events like what we're going on, and so. In that way, it's interesting to compare the two pieces, from the totally concrete, unrelated to history, for all intents and purposes, mm-hmm. And then this Prokofiev, which is deeply related,
but deeply related, but still, and this is what great art does, incredibly universal.
Absolutely, I mean, it's. Any great, I'm sure there are a lot of pieces out there. Wellington's March by Beethoven, for instance. There are a lot of great pieces that are tied to historic events, but which don't pass the test of
sure.
Are they universal?
Right.
And so, there are a lot. Yeah, but this piece does pass both tests. Not sure which tests. It's not like you have a piece has to be related to current events to be universal, but this one is, it's one of the most incredible pieces for me. I mean, I grew up listening to this piece and just finding it, just having it strike a chord within me, really. More than most other pieces, just it allowed me to get inside of it, or it got inside of me in a totally unironic way. As mm-hmm. adults we kind of have this layer of knowledge and judgment that's between us and whatever we're watching, listening to, whatever
right.
it is. This piece is not, for me, it's no holds barred, just in it. And it's quite a ride.
The concert is Saturday night. Baton goes up at 7:30, correct?
Well, hopefully it comes down at 7:30.
Okay, well, it's got to go up before it comes down, right?
Exactly. Now you want to get into physics now.
Yeah. And Walton Arts Center.
That's right.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Kyle.
Oh, and there will be a conversation beforehand.
Yes, with you, actually.
Yeah, we'll do more of this.
Absolutely. So that's at 6:45, I believe, or thereabouts.
Right, in Star.
Star Theater, that's right. Right. Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Paul.
Take care.
African lions carol to each other this cold, sunny afternoon, claiming their stake on Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge. They share their quarters with 117 tigers, cougars, leopards, and bobcats. Nearby, an array of striped Bengal tigers lazily doze in their dens. But one, named Ty, suddenly rouses as refuge staff Kelly Jo Carroll approaches his cage, making chuffing sounds, showing him a white canvas. The 14-year-old tiger gracefully jumps off his perch and prowls towards her, chuffing back. As Ty watches, Kelly Jo drips and swirls turquoise, yellow, and aqua blue non-toxic paint over the canvas, lays it on the ground, then using a rebar hook, pushes it partially into the cage. Ty grabs it with one large orange paw and starts to lick.
Yeah. Here, You're doing a good job. Yeah, look at that face.
Ty uses his rough tongue to mix the thick puddles of paint into dense waves and swirls. Kelly Jo assists, turning the canvas this way and that. Suddenly, he stops and looks up. He's done.
Good job, Ty.
You did a good job.
Now you good boy. Are you done? Is that it? Do you guys like it? You did a good job.
Kelly Jo Carroll from Buffalo, New York, is one of more than 300 college students who've completed a six-month internship at this refuge. But she, like the Tigers, has taken a permanent position. Rain's been watching us the whole time. She's right next door. We see if she's in the mood to paint. Not.
Come on, Beth. Come here. Come on. You want to paint today or not?
We leave the grumpy tiger to her nap in search of another artist. Staff don't enter any of the 30 by 50 foot enclosures unless the big cats are safely sequestered. The art making is always facilitated from outside the cages. The only real hazard to watch for is when a cat turns around and lifts a tail. Speaking of scents, canvases are sprayed with a fruit or floral fragrance, and some of the fussier cats prefer designer-name perfumes.
They love any kind of new scent. They'll come and investigate it. They have an organ in the roof of their mouth called the Jacobson's organ, and they'll do this kind of funny-looking face called a stinky face. We call it a stinky face. But they're trying to get the chemical receptors to the roof of their mouth. So they love smelling any kind of new scent.
In the wild, large cats rely on their extraordinary sense of smell to hunt, procreate, or attract predators. But imagine what a spritz of herbal catnip might create. We check out one more artist, Bam Bam, a gymammoth grizzly bear who's using a brown and pink palette today.
You sneaky bear, look at you.
Starting to close his eyes.
He's like, ooh, chocolate, raspberry.
Bam Bam makes some final touches to the canvas using his long black tongue.
He's getting a little bit better, but he's also a big licker. So sometimes you look at the canvas and you're missing most of the paint. So it's like a very like watercolor kind of artwork. So he's probably our best yet.
Unlike the tigers, whose muzzles are smeared with paint afterward, the grizzly is very neat. Lions also paint, but not today. Something's up with them.
Sometimes they'll tell each other before a storm comes. Even if we actually have a vet come, they'll warn each other that a vet's coming and hide in their dens. So they'll say all sorts of things. right now they're probably talking about, does anyone see the food? How much longer till supper time?
The animals are fed once a day, late afternoon, but are continually enriched.
Every day the interns go around and they'll give them enrichment throughout the day. Sometimes it's cardboard boxes with hay in there, or cedar, or a burlap sack with some sort of grass or something inside that they can rip open and use their nails and teeth like it was a prey. On their birthdays, they all get something. Sometimes interns will make some sort of meatsicle or a fruitsicle for our bear in the summer months. And then in the winter, they'll get like presents that are wrapped and there'll be something inside and the cats will rip them open, or some sort of big cardboard animal that's in their habitat and they go and pounce on it. So it's really cute seeing what the interns will come up with for enrichment.
The cages are also equipped with bowling balls and pins and other toys to keep the cats interested and exercised. Turpentine Creek, established in 1995, is now filled with clean, spacious enclosures, one quarter concrete, the rest grassland habitat. But of an estimated 60 big cat sanctuaries nationwide, only one big cat rescue in Tampa, Florida, creates and markets so-called paw paintings. Last year, Turpentine Creek, which has been doing paw paintings for about a year, auctioned a dozen original big cat artworks, raising several thousand dollars. $15 reproductions are also for sale in the gift shop, with artists' bios attached.
A lot of these artworks are very original, like right over here for B.B. King, you can see his paw prints that go across the canvas. Some of them you can actually see nail marks or teeth marks or holes in it and things like that. Some of them they really get into the painting. Sometimes you'll have fur on the paintings as well.
Adding exciting value to the abstract expressionist works, proceeds go towards swimming pools and misters to keep cats cool in the summer, and cozy blankets, straw nests, and heaters in the winter. Turpentine Wildlife Refuge, 7 miles south of Eureka Springs, has been in the news recently for rescuing nearly a dozen large cats from another nonprofit sanctuary near Mountainburg, which is failing. It costs $7,000 to transport, treat, and house each new rescue. Many animals arrive sick, starving, or crippled from confinement. The refuge feeds on average 1,500 pounds of raw meat per day to the carnivores, donated by Tyson Foods, Zero Mountain, and Walmart stores. A dozen new enclosures had to be constructed this winter in a nearby valley to accommodate a surge of incoming. The nonprofit refuge annual operating budget is around $1 million a year, provided by foundations, contributions, and visitors who pay a small fee for a guided tour. None of the animals are bred or adopted. All are fortunate to live out their lives here. As for our pod painters, they're on task this winter, working towards a group exhibit this spring. After all, there's lots more cat toys to purchase. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Turpentine Creek is hosting its second annual Cats at the Castle Dinner and Paw Painting Auction at Castle Rogues Manor in Beaver, Arkansas. That's Saturday, April 27th. The event benefits the Habitat Fund. If you'd like to learn more, you can visit turpentinecreek.org. Plus, we're excited about this. We've posted a palette of Turpentine Creek paw paintings, as well as a music video produced by Sophie Kidd, our own Sophie Kidd, on the Ozarks at Large website. Many thanks to Jamie Froelich for that city camera work as well. It is Thursday, January 24th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Jody Beznoska, who is Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center. You and your colleagues at Walton Arts Center have had not a slow January, but a calm January.
A calmer January, sure.
And you're about to rip the Band-Aid off.
Yeah, we're about
to get crazy again.
About to get going. We're a little quiet this week, We have Sona this weekend.
Right. That's at 7:30 Saturday night.
7:30 Saturday night, correct. And then I believe our next show at the WAC will be Memphis, which we've been talking about forever, but I'm so excited. I can't wait.
6-night, 8-show run.
Correct, yep. This is the touring version of the Tony Award-winning Broadway show. It's set, obviously, in Memphis, and it features all original music, and it's just a really wonderful show. Someone was asking me the other day, you know, well, why should I go? Why is it good? And I kept saying, it's just good. You should just come.
End of story.
It's just a great musical. But it's nice to see a musical with original music. It's the choreography is very unique and very interesting. And the story is really touching. It's really compelling. It's about a white DJ in the 50s who falls in love with black music and also with a black singer, and how that their relationship isn't really okay at that time, but they do it anyway, and the things they deal with and the sort of journey they take as a couple and the music takes. You know, the neatest thing, I think, is that this white DJ really wants to play this music, this black music, on stations that have never heard it before. And so as radio people, it's really neat to watch him play with the radio and figure out how he can, like, sneak this music on. And, of course, it takes everyone by storm and they fall in love with it. So it's a great, great show. It's the 5th through the 10th, 8 performances, like we said. Tickets available for all of those shows. It starts on a Tuesday, ends on a Sunday.
Right.
And then our next show, I believe, will in the middle of their Sons of the Prophet will start with, for Theater Squared, their third show of the season.
Right.
I believe they're in rehearsals for that. They've just started rehearsals for that right now. That's a good one to, that's a very recent show that was just on Broadway.
Right.
And it's really funny.
Very fresh, like 2 years ago on Broadway.
Yeah. Then in February, again, on the 16th and the 17th, we will have Potted Potter, the unauthorized Harry Potter experience.
Okay, I saw some pictures of you on Facebook with some Harry Potter glasses.
Yes, that was last night.
Okay.
We were at the basketball game handing out Harry Potter glasses.
All right.
And so if you want Harry Potter glasses, find me. I will have some. I can give them to you. But we're all a bunch of Harry Potter geeks in the communications office, so we're kind of thrilled for this show. It is a parody of the Harry Potter series. It is two guys from Britain. They take all seven Harry Potter books and they put them into a 70-minute live show. So it has an element of improv to it. It has lots of audience interaction to it. And it's just going to be really crazy and really funny. I learned that the reason they even have this show is someone asked them to do a 5-minute parody for the line at a bookstore for one of the books. I think it was the sixth book. So there's going to be a big line at the bookstore, and they asked these two actors to entertain the folks in line. And so they did this, and it was such a hit that they decided to turn it into a show. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. I'm kind of excited for that. That's on the 16th and the 17th of February. That's one that it's recommended for ages 6 and up. So I will be bringing my friends, but my other friends will be bringing their kids. So it'll be a real mix of people at this one. And then we will also, on the 16th, we'll have, I think it's the third or fourth show in our Starlight Jazz series, the Grace Kelly Quintet.
Right. That she is what, early 20s,
early 20s
at oldest.
Yeah.
And has already been on in world stages around.
Yeah. It's really, really kind of amazing that we have her. I think that's going to be a pretty spectacular evening. That's the 16th. On the 19th, we'll have The Little Prince, a show for kids and families. And on the 22nd through the 23rd, we will have Hair, the revival touring version of the Broadway classic.
It's all in February.
All February.
So Hair's just two nights?
That's correct. It's two nights,
okay.
But I believe it's three shows
right.
over the course of those 2 days.
So it's not your standard Broadway
run. Right.
That's correct. It's not a week. It's just over on the weekend. And then looking ahead into March, we want to look to Garrison Keillor, of course, on March 28th. Sir James Galway and his wife, Lady Jean Galway, on March 14th. And then I want to make sure to get Anything Goes on people's calendars. That's April 9th through the 14th. And the Monterey Jazz Festival, also in April. So lots of good things. And, of course, you can get tickets to all of these things at 443-5600 or waltonartscenter.org. Or you can come down and see us and check out our new gallery exhibition, which is very cool. Scott Carroll's work is up
there. I haven't seen it since he put it up. I talked to him as he was putting it up, and there were some big pieces.
Yeah, it's a combination of sculpture and wall pieces. But even the wall pieces are three-dimensional.
Right.
Like, they're not really paintings. They're carvings and their sculpture. But it's great. The work is really, really interesting and just really pleasant and nice to look at. So we have like three or four standing sculptures and then lots of art on the wall.
All right. Thank you, Jody. Jody Buznoska is Vice President for Communications at Walton Arts Center.
Support for KUAF comes from 2NJOY Magazine, a monthly publication offering local arts, culture, and entertainment. Subscriptions and more information available at 464-8900 or numeral 2NJOYMag.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Eureka Springs.
There you go, Eureka Springs. Yesterday, to give away three sets of Sona tickets, I asked the question. Yes, it was on yesterday's date in 1957 that Walter Frederick Morrison sold his invention to Wham-O, an invention he called the Pluto Platter. And the question was, what do we now more commonly call Walter's invention?
Oh, I don't know.
The Pluto Platter.
Pluto Platter.
No guess?
I don't know. I'm picturing like one of those chip and dip bowls,
Wham-O.
I don't know what Wham-O is.
Wham-O makes toys.
Oh.
So if I told you it was a toy,
I still
the Frisbee.
Know.
Oh. The Frisbee. Douglas Duane Rhodes, Allison Ransom, and Amy Partak Lee among those who answered correctly. Congratulations. You each have two tickets to see Sona. It will be at Will Call at Walton Arts Center on Saturday night at 7:30. So again, that's Douglas Duane Rhodes, Allison Ransom, Amy Partak Lee. I'll send you an email soon about that. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellum.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Do you like to play Frisbee?
Sure.
Okay, very good. thanks for listening.
Happy Thursday.